Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Charity Digital podcast. And today we'll be discussing the ever important topic of how to protect charities from fraud. My name is Liz, and I'm your host. And joining me as our guest speakers are Rick Wilhelm, Chief Technology Officer from the Public Interest Registry in the US. Rick is located in Washington, DC. So we really appreciate his dedication in joining us on a different time zone. And we have Ian Crosby, Network Quality Lead from Mind UK, who is by no means a stranger to Charity Digital, as I've had the pleasure of hosting a webinar on cybersecurity with Ian recently. Now, if this is your first time listening, a very warm welcome to you. And if you're a regular, welcome back to another informative and exciting podcast. In fact, I would say it's an essential one that we all need to listen to, as Rick and Ian will be discussing everything charities need to know about fraud, including the various risks they face and what they can do to prevent it. It may seem and feel quite shocking to all of us when people might want to commit fraud in the charity sector, a sector that exists for the benefit of others and is in the business of doing good for their service users, for the communities they serve, and for society as a whole. And research from the Charity Commission estimates that fraud costs the charity sector more than $2 million each year. Whether that be insider fraud or external attacks, charities most definitely need to be protected. And just before we delve into this topic, I just want to give a heads up that this year's Charity Fraud Awareness Week will be taking place on the 17th to the 21st of October. It's a great way for charities to talk about fraud with staff, beneficiaries, and supporters. And you can find out more about what's going on the Preventing Charity Fraud website, hashtag Stop Charity Fraud. Let's crack on with this podcast in hand. Welcome, Rick and Ian. How are you both doing?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, hope all is well for you.
I was going to say, how's your week going? But we're just on Monday, aren't we? Just at the start of the week. So I'm glad to hear that you're both well. Rick, shall we just kick off with you? And just, can I ask you a general question? What is charity fraud?
So there's a lot of different kinds of charity fraud, as probably most of our listeners here know, right? When you think about fraud, I sort of tend to think about it in terms of two large buckets, if you will. Insider fraud, right, which is fraud that would be committed against a charity by people that are working with, for people that we'd consider part of the charity. And then there's external fraud. Insider fraud, people submitting false expenses, misusing charity money. That's sort of a well-understood concept for most here within that are listening to this. External fraud is a little bit different and a lot more varied. Earlier at the beginning, Liz, you said we're going to cover everything about fraud. I don't know that we would have enough storage space to record a podcast of that length, and certainly our listeners probably wouldn't have that much stamina to listen to us drone on about that. But external fraud can come in a variety of categories, right? You can charity can be subject to a phishing attack, right, where people work on attacking users to steal passwords to go and extract money from the charity, could be doing unauthorized fundraising, could be doing data exfiltration, a lot of different external things. We'll dive into more of those kind of things, but I sort of think about external and internal as a good two different ways to kind of just roughly categorize it.
Yeah, that's really good. And thank you for that characterization. It is interesting. Ian, what do you think? What are charities most at risk from?
Well, I suppose it kind of it comes under both elements, really, both internal and external. But I think the kind of things that lead to fraud are things like too much, one person in the organization having too much responsibility for the organization's assets, whether that be a staff member or a trustee. And alongside that, a lack of oversight. So obviously we want the kind of general day-to-day duties to be being overseen by somebody senior that can check that any controls that are in place are being adhered to. And all of those kind of like just stop the internal or external fraud happening because it means that there's checks in place that happen that catch it. and then it can be prevented. Alongside that, things like effective cybersecurity and training for staff and trustees as well. And for me, one of the core issues that come down to it that tends to lead to fraud or even prevent it, hopefully, is having a good policy, a robust policy in place. When a charity doesn't have the policy in place, the procedures that it needs to go through aren't clear and people don't know what to follow. But having that in place has shown that actually it can pick up to kind of 2/3 of potential fraud attacks, whether that be internal or external fraud.
Okay. And I guess, you know, obviously charities are targeted just like everybody else, but would it affect charities in a different way that it affects other companies? Or what do you think about how it is affecting them?
So I suppose the first thing that most people think about is the kind of financial implications. So most fraud does involve getting money from people or misuse of money. Beyond that, so there's the reputational damage that it can cause. Actually, you're not using your money effectively. So particularly if people have raised money for you through fundraising and that then gets taken away, obviously you weren't protecting that money. And that therefore that has a knock-on effect, which has a reduced impact for the beneficiary. So you're not able to offer the same level of services for your beneficiaries that you could. And then internally, there's a reduction in trust in the organization, both from the staff and its supporters, and the morale of the workforce can drop quite significantly as well if they see that actually all their hard work is coming to nothing because of this fraud that's happening. Then it can have real implications on that morale. And obviously, ultimately, it could all lead to closure, particularly for smaller charities. They may not have the resources to back up what's happening. And so it could end up that they have to close and nobody gets supported.
Yeah. Rick, what's your take on that one?
Yeah, I would completely agree with what Ian said there. Fraud can cause an existential crisis for a charity because the lifeblood of a charity is trust. Trust from the donors, which provides the funding, and then also the trust from the public, and their charity is really a steward of that trust. And when fraud gets in there, whether it be internal is always a very painful situation with charities, but if it's external fraud, that implies that the charity, you know, didn't have those effective policies, as Ian was mentioning, didn't have those effective procedures, wasn't governing itself properly, which is it's worse than having the proverbial one bad apple that is inside the charity, because that those kind of things are leadership driven and they come from the top, those policies and procedures. So it can cause an existential crisis for the charity, and it really is a reflection on the leadership of the charity, those kind of policies and procedures and things like that. So completely agree with what Ian was saying there.
So if we're sort of going to be looking about how we're detecting fraud, I mean, maybe you could give us some like advice and tips on this. And Ian, what do you think, what is counter-fraud culture? I've heard that quite a lot, but I'm not really too sure if you could go into that for us.
Yeah, so I think kind of just echoing what Rick was just saying, it starts right at the top. So trustees, senior leaders, senior managers, and it's about kind of embedding counter-fraud activity in all levels of the organization. So it's about making sure those checks are in place, that the people are doing what they should be doing, and both internal and external, and that the charity is using its resources to the best of its ability. So a lot of charities kind of build themselves on trust, and I think that's right. But kind of alongside that, there needs to be accountability as well. So you can't just rely on the trust and assume that people are doing well because they're good people. Actually, you need to have that accountability and make sure people are doing their jobs properly to prevent both internal and external fraud. But for me, I thought it's the kind of main element of counter-fraud culture, which kind of follows on from all that, is about the openness, the transparency of what's happening in the organization. So I recently worked with one of our local mine branches who had done a real lot of work about embedding their values across the organization. And one of their values was openness. And it really came across at all levels that they were open and there was no secrets within the organization. Yes, there was confidentiality in terms of kind of data protection and that sort of things, but actually in terms of sharing their experiences and sharing what they're finding and flagging up issues, that was all really encouraged, and there was a real kind of transparent culture across the organization. And alongside that went the kind of the no blame. So it wasn't about finding out somebody had done something wrong. It was actually about something's not working. What can we do to make this better? So about learning, constantly trying to improve. And I always find that's echoed with the way organizations encourage whistleblowing. So you get most organizations these days, I think, will have whistleblowing policies, but some of them I've come across have been quite aggressive, shall we say, where they accept them, but they don't really want them. But actually, I think the sign of a really good, open, transparent organization is actually, we really want you to whistleblow, whether that's internally or externally, because you telling us what's going wrong means we can fix it and make it better. And I think that kind of all comes into the culture.
So is that sort of whistleblowing for inside and outside as well, sort of, you know, how do supporters spot their fraudulent fundraising as well? Rick, what are your thoughts on that?
So when it comes to things like whistleblowing, I think that is a, you know, having tools that are there for, you know, sometimes I think that whistleblowing, I think that terminology has a, unfortunately, sometimes a rather negative and a very pejorative tone to it. You know, sometimes if using terminology that relates to, you know, reporting mechanisms and helping us learn and feedback mechanisms and things like that can accomplish exactly what Ian was talking about. When they're described, whether it be internally or externally, they can take on a multidimensional capability that not only helps organizations capture the negative when it's there, but also capture the positive, right? Because sometimes if the thing has turned to like a whistleblower hotline, it can sort of, you know, attract that sort of things about, you know, people that are trying to you know, kind of maybe stir up trouble or something like that. But also organizations need to, any charity, of course, wants feedback. And so, you know, feedback mechanisms, it's important that they be used for listening for positive feedback, as well as, you know, as Ian was saying, the negative feedback. And sometimes it's being taking that feedback that people get and listening to it closely and picking up on subtle things that can turn into a whistleblowing issue, where you pick up on those small things that realize that, oh, wait a second, this didn't quite match up. Because, you know, oftentimes if you go and you delve deeply into a fraud case, you realize that there were multiple situations where the perpetrator just barely got away with it. And if someone would have made one more phone call or sent one email to check on XYZ, the perpetrator would have gotten stopped farther back in time, right? It's sort of like a classical, it's almost like in a movie, that kind of thing. And so I think that's sort of the thing that when Ian was talking about, that it kind of resonated strongly with me, right? So yeah, I think protecting from fraud also is important for, you know, to help train your employees of the and volunteers and trustees in what good looks like. And going back to the topic we were talking about earlier about what policies are, you know, policies can also help serve as a North Star for the organization about what good looks like, where we should be going, and then having those policies not be stagnant, but iterate them and refine them from time to time, refresh them. Maybe it's annually, maybe it's biannually, something like that. Those are also important things, I think, for charities to undertake.
Yeah, Ian, did you want to follow on with anything that Rick has said? Those are really great points.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with what you were saying about policies and about the training, just to kind of reiterate that. I think training is key. And I think what's important is that organizations don't just do some training about fraud or cybersecurity or whatever it is during induction and think that's it, that's done. Actually, it needs to be regularly refreshed, and little and often is really good. So I've had organizations that have sent out kind of monthly, quarterly, whatever it is, surveys for people to try just to kind of refresh their memory and see what it is. Asking at staff meetings, just doing a 5-minute quick fire training session at staff meetings, just to really keep it fresh in people's minds. So as Rick said, with that North Star of the policy, this is what we're aiming for, and just reminding people of what that goal is, and so that they know what they're aiming for. And it might be that people don't get it right 100% of the time, but at least they know what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, so that goes hand in hand with what you were saying earlier, with to create a culture of transparency. And they should be really clear on how to report incidents, right? And the ways through to do it and who to go through.
That goes back to my no blame culture. And I think there's like Rick was saying about the feedback, it's about having multiple routes that people can raise issues. So it might be the kind of formal whistleblowing, but hopefully it wouldn't actually get to that stage and people would feel able just to go and speak to their manager or bring it up in a supervision or anything like that. But they flag it up so that worse fraud down the line might be prevented because they've raised an issue when it's only a small thing. The whole kind of issue of reporting it externally and the kind of legal obligations and like requirements of their insurance to do that. And if a charity doesn't know that it has an issue, then it can't report that externally. So it could raise bigger issues down the line as well.
Yeah, no, exactly. If it doesn't know it has an issue, that goes well with what Rick said. You know, it's just one more phone call that was just needed, wasn't it? Just a little bit more investigation that would have been exploded the issue there. Yeah. Did you have anything else to add, Rick, before I go on to another question?
I think equipping your people with good tools is also very important. I think just like charities have invested in good tools for financial tracking and things like that, tools in the area of security are also very, very important. So I think that's another important topic that charities, it's not an area to skimp on, right? You just like you want a good person, a good financial controller working with your charity to keep track of all the funds. Security is an important part of that because financial security and digital security sort of go hand in hand to be a good foundation of trust for a charity.
Yeah, that's a really good point, isn't it? That's sort of one of the steps that charities can take to protect themselves. Ian, how would you run sort of effective background checks from volunteers to trustees?
Yeah, so I think background checks are kind of one element of it, but I think people need to be aware of the limitations of them as well. So obviously most recruitment activities will include DBS checks where they're appropriate and references as well. But both of them kind of only provide a limited amount of information and only information on what's gone before. So it's not a guarantee about what's going to happen next. So I would certainly encourage people to be doing it as one element of their kind of their checking. But there's other that they need to have those kind of ongoing policies and procedures in place to make sure they're doing it as they're have that counter fraud culture as well. In terms of references, I think it seems to be getting harder and harder to get good references. A lot of organizations are becoming more worried about sharing information because of data protection. Obviously, it isn't an issue in terms of GDPR, but people are becoming more wary about it. So I think it's being very clear what information you're asking for when you're asking for references. So whether you're asking for just confirmation that they have worked there when they said they worked there and there weren't any major issues with them, or whether you want a bit more about their kind of their work ethic when they were there, and making sure that those questions are very clear in the references, or even having a phone call with the person that you're asking for the reference from. I think that's really useful as well. And then obviously when it comes to trustees who kind of have the overarching control of the charity, a lot of charities are already doing eligibility declarations, making sure that people are saying they're eligible, but they need to be going on things like the insolvency registers as well and the director disqualification register, and making sure for themselves that actually the people they're planning to appoint as trustees haven't been disqualified, aren't ineligible. So I think it's about just being quite proactive in those background checks and making sure that you're getting as much information about the people that you're putting in positions of power as you can.
And do you think, Ian, that there's sort of a checkbox process that people can work through? Where would they go to find something like that?
I'm quite a big fan of a checklist, particularly when it comes to things like that, because I think it just means things aren't forgotten. I know the Charity Commission has some checklists on there for engaging trustees. But other than that, I think an internet search will flag up some things and good examples. But then it's about checking that and making sure it fits with your organization. Because again, if you're working with vulnerable individuals, it might be that you need to add some things in there to make it more appropriate for the way your organization works and the work that the person you're employing is going to be doing.
Thank you, Rick. Just moving over to you now, what do you think of the importance of teams staying connected?
Oh, you know, it's usually important. I mean, there's obviously for the teams, you know, correct, proper and excellent functioning. It's very important for their emotional and social well-being, very important, but also in the area of fraud, right? In preventing fraud, it's something that is, which is our topic here today, of course, it's something that is hugely important because while I don't necessarily have a statistic, no one commits, well, rarely. It's more difficult to commit fraud in the middle of a big room where everyone sees it, where everyone is watching you work, right? The classical image of crime being committed is sort of in the dark when the criminal is by themselves, right? And so teams staying connected and communicating with each other about what is going on, what is happening, what funds are moving around, what digital assets are being moved around, what physical assets are being moved around, why they're moving, when they're moving, what the plan is. All that sort of transparency and communication can be a real help to fraud prevention. And so the team staying connected, having the right digital tools for those, having the right, as we said, processes in place, hugely important there, as well as, you know, in addition to it being good for safety and maintaining the integrity, it's good for, I think, it's good for teams to maintain that connection. And obviously, even before the pandemic situation, a lot of charities were sort of dispersed because just due to the nature of volunteer work. And so that kind of connectedness is important regardless.
Don't they say, Rick, that 70% of fraud happens because too much responsibility is given to one person?
I would place a bet on that number. I mean,
or
that sounds,
I just
about
plucked that out of the air.
I don't doubt you. That sounds good to me. Yeah. That's the kind of thing that happens, right?
I read another stat that said something about, I think it was about 2/3 of fraud happens from somebody known to the charity. So whether that's a staff member or volunteer or a beneficiary, but that's about, again it's that importance of being connected and actually talking to each other so that there isn't that opportunity for somebody to sit in a dark room and commit fraud.
Yeah, it's so important, isn't it? Gosh, well, we talked a little bit about, you know, sort of best practices. Ian, do you want to say anything else?
I'm a bit of a policy nerd. So for me, the key thing is about having a really clear and robust policy and procedure. That's your step one, basically, because that's setting the ground rules. It's setting your goals that you're aiming for. And within that, having things like segregation of duties and limits to authority so that no one person has control over particularly the whole finance function, but even when it comes to data as well, because obviously you can commit data fraud as well. So it's about having segregation of duties within the data protection systems as well. Knowing and prioritizing your risks, your fraud risks as well. So as part of your risk management process is actually just being clear where are we at risk of fraud here and what are we doing and what can we do to address this and to mitigate against it. And then obviously there's a whole kind of cybersecurity areas that come into this and help to address this. And I think I'm going to hand over to Rick and let him talk about cybersecurity.
Go, Rick, go.
So for limiting fraud, cybersecurity, as we've been talking about, is super important. Obviously, you know, we had talked earlier about training. You know, Ian had mentioned the importance of doing training, talked about doing it in small bites, small chunks, and the having consistent, regular training in that regard. I'm a huge fan of that, as opposed to dragging the team into a conference room for a day long session once a year, feeding them some pastries and putting them to sleep for an 8-hour day or something like that. It's much better if you give them a little training very, very often, right? So then also as it relates to security, you know, we mentioned trust is a big asset of the charity. Another asset that charities end up having, which makes them a great target, is not only the money, obviously, but also data. Charities have a lot of data. And Ian mentioned GDPR earlier. One of the things that, you know, as we've all learned more and more about GDPR, I think that smarter charities are getting better about both minimizing the amount of data they collect, which is, you know, obviously important from a compliance perspective, but also discarding the data that they no longer need, even if they had legitimately connected it previously. And so that's an important thing to realize, that that data that a charity may have legitimately collected, if they no longer need it, try to get rid of it, because then that's data that can't leak, right? If you're breached, that means that the amount of data that you leak will be that much smaller. And maybe there's that many hundred or thousand or tens of, depending on your charity, of people that are not involved. And so you minimize your risk in that way by minimizing the data that you keep, both in the number of data subjects, as well as the amount of data per subject, those two different dimensions, right? So I think those are important things when it comes to security.
Yeah, those are really good points. Thank you. Thanks, Rick, on that. Ian, anything else to mention?
Yeah, I just think I was just listening to Rick there and thinking about him talking about data minimization. And actually, I think kind of the same applies when it comes to financial assets as well. So minimizing kind of what potential fraudsters have access to. So whether that be spreading charity funds across multiple accounts, or investing it in investment accounts to actually raise money, but actually just having less cash around, either in a cash box or in a bank account, so that the member of the finance team or anybody else might have access to, it means that there's less, if fraud does occur, it's going to be less impactful than it would be if it was all just sat in one big honeypot and people could just go in and get it.
Great point, Ian. Definitely. So Rick and Ian, okay, we're obviously talking and we're going over some really great tips and advice what people can do, but investing financially in cybersecurity isn't really expensive. I mean, we've talked about training, we've talked about getting snippets to, you know, every now and then, and not these massive big sort of one day events that you've said, and everything else, getting people involved and policies. But what about those small, medium-sized charities out there that are struggling?
Right. So it certainly can be, right? It certainly can be. And obviously, there are a lot of very, very large corporations that spend massive amounts of money on cybersecurity on an annual basis. I think that the challenge, but it doesn't need to be. And cybersecurity is an area where I think that the mindset needs to be, as the saying goes, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, right? So just because you can't do, or stated another way, just because you can't do everything doesn't mean you shouldn't do something. And I think that sometimes in certain situations, and not just in the area of charities and cybersecurity, people say, well, I can't fully fix the problem, so I'm just, you know, why bother? Well, in the area of cybersecurity, even if you just work with three users to improve their, let's say, improve their password hygiene, make their passwords better, that may actually be the difference between your organization having a breach or not. It maybe it's just one user, right? Maybe it's just your chief controller, right? And so, or maybe it's just a training session, or maybe it where you talk about how to you grab your phone and update all of your apps or keep the OS on there. So it doesn't have to be a big investment. If you can spend money, that's great. But also, this is another time where charities can look out to their stakeholders. And a lot of people are very willing to volunteer and help out in this area, because they sometimes people, you know, and I'm by no means the smartest person in the world in the area of cybersecurity, but if I can help a friend with their cybersecurity, I might actually be saving myself some headaches, because maybe I don't have to come and help them fix their iPhone or Android in the future, something like that. So incrementalism is really possible in the area of cybersecurity. So don't be afraid to make it a little bit better, because that might just be the thing that saves you.
Fantastic. Ian, have you got anything else to add to that before I wrap up?
Yeah. So just to kind of say that, like kind of Rick kind of touched upon it, but just to say there isn't really a one size fits all to any of this. It's each charity is so unique in the way it operates, in its size, in its structure, that I think it's just about thinking what's the best thing for us to do? What one thing can we do that will improve our cybersecurity, our security, our anti-fraud procedures? Obviously, like Rick was saying, getting somebody to help in it, that you might consider appointing a trustee who's got like risk management, anti-fraud knowledge, behavior, get them on the board. You're getting their skills for free then. They're given their time. But also in terms of going back to the training that we were mentioning, there's so much free or very cheap training out there that people can access. So the National Cybersecurity Center has got some excellent training, kind of 5-minute trainings on things like passwords and access control and those sorts of things. There was an excellent webinar a couple of months ago about cybersecurity for charity leaders that somebody did with Charity Digital as well. So go ahead and watch things like that. But it's not about reinventing the wheel. It's actually go and look what's out there. And I think, like Rick was touching upon, actually liaising with other charities that are in a similar position. Have they got the knowledge that they can share with you? Or if not, can you work together and actually maybe you might be able to pool it and buy in the knowledge together? So it's not just all on one charity. It's actually everybody's getting the skills, but for less money then. So I think, yeah, it's about thinking, what can we do with the time and the resources and the capability we've got already, rather than trying to reach for the stars and go for what multi-million pound corporations do, because it's not appropriate for small and medium charities.
Agreed. Completely, Ian. Absolutely. Yes. Rick, anything else?
Plus one to what Ian said there. That's brilliant. Bang on.
It is bang on. That's really good to end on that one. It's been a great discussion. Thank you so much. Very, very valuable advice, information, great takeaways for everyone to get their teeth into and take action on. Thank you so much, Rick and Ian, for taking the time and supporting our podcast. And to you, our listeners, thank you for being with us. We hope that you've enjoyed this podcast and you've been inspired to press ahead and prevent fraud in your charities. Enjoy the rest of your day, everyone, and we'll hope you'll connect with us very soon. And bye for now.